Side 23. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 824. So the conferees at the Gross Suckling Conference here, as it will come to be known, sit around a map with their instruments, cigarettes, and speculations. Sneer not. Here is one of the great deductive moments in post-war intelligence. Mexico is holding out for a weighting system to make vector lengths proportional to the actual number of firings along each one. Thomas Gwenhidwe, ever sensitive to events in geographical space, wants to take the 1944 Blizna firings, also eastward, into account, which would pull the arrow northward from 354 degrees, and even closer to true north if the firings at London and Norwich from Walcheren and Stavoren are also included. Evidence and intuition, and maybe a residue of uncivilizable terror that lies inside us, everyone, point to 000 degrees, true north. What better direction to fire the 00000? Trouble is, what good's a bearing, even a mythic symmetric bearing, without knowing where the rocket was fired from to begin with? You have a razor edge 280 kilometer long sweeping east-west across the zone's pocked face, endlessly sweeping, obsessive, dithering, glittering, unbearable, never coming to rest. Well, under the sign of the Gross Suckling, swaying full-color picture of a loathsomely fat, drooling infant, in one pudding-like fist, the Gross Suckling clutches a dripping ham hock. Sorry, pigs, nothing personal. With the other, he reaches out for a human mother's nipple that emerges out into the picture from the left-hand side, his gaze arrested by the approaching tit, his mouth open, a gleeful look, teeth pointed and itching, a glaze of food, munch, munch, yes, gobble, mmm, over his eyes, der grob Zeugling, 23rd card of the zone's Trump's major. Roger likes to think of it as a snap of Jeremy as a child. Jeremy, who knows all, has forgiven Jessica her time with Roger. He's had an outing or two himself and can understand, he's of liberal mind, the war, after all, has taken down certain barriers. Victorianisms, you might say. A tale brought to you by the same jokers who invented the famous polyvinyl chloride coat. And watch this, Roger, he's trying to impress you. His eyelids make high, amiable crescents as he leans forward, smaller chap than Roger thought, clutching his glass, sucking on the most tasteless pipe Roger has ever seen, a reproduction in briar of Winston Churchill's head for a bowl, no detail is spared, even a cigar in its mouth with a little hole drilled down it so that some of the smoke can actually seep out the end. It is a serviceman's pub in Cuxhaven here. The place used to be a marine salvage yard, so the lonesome soldiers sit dreaming and drinking among all that nautical junk. Not at the same level as in one's usual outdoor cafe, no. Some are up in tilted hatchways or dangling in bosun's chairs, crow's nests, sitting over their bitter among the chain, tackle, strake work, black iron fittings. It's night. Lanterns have been brought out to the tables. Soft little nocturnal waves hush on the shingle. Late waterfowl cry out over the lake. But will it ever get us, Jeremy, you and me? That's the question. Mexico has been uttering these oracular, often, as at the club today for lunch, quite embarrassing bits of his ever since he showed up. Will what ever get me, old chap? It's been old chap all day. Haven't you ever felt something wanted to guess you, Jeremy? Get me? He's drunk. He's insane. I obviously can't let him near Jessica. These math chaps, they're like oboe players. It affects the brain or something. Aha, but once a month, Jeremy, even Jeremy, dreams about a gambling debt. Different sorts of collectors keep arriving. He cannot remember the debt, the opponent he lost to, even the game. He senses a great organization behind these emissaries. Its threats are always left open, left for Jeremy to complete. Each time, terror has come welling up through the gap. Crystal terror. Good, good. The other surefire calibration test has already been sprung on Jeremy. At a prearranged spot in a park, two unemployed Augustes leap out in white face and working clothes and commence belting each other with gigantic, 7 or 8 feet long, foam rubber penises, cunningly detailed all in natural color. These fancy phalli have proven to be a good investment. Roger and Seaman Bodine, when he's in town, have outdrawn the ENSA shows. It is a fine source of spare change. Multitudes will gather at the edges of these North German villages to watch the two zanies whack away. Granaries, mostly empty, poke up above the rooftops now and then, stretching a wood gallows arm against the afternoon sky. Soldiers, civilians, and children. There is a lot of laughter. Seems people can be reminded of titans and fathers and laugh. It isn't as funny as a pie in the face, but it's at least as pure. Yes, giant rubber cocks are here to stay as part of the arsenal. What Jessica said, hair much shorter, wearing a darker mouth of different outline, harder lipstick, her typewriter banking in a phalanx of letters between them, was, "We're going to be married. We're trying very hard to have a baby." All at once there is nothing but this asshole between gravity and Roger. "I don't care. Have his baby. I love you both. Just come with me, Jess, please. I need you." She flips a red lever on her intercom. Far away, a buzzer goes off. Security. Her voice is perfectly hard, the words still clap-echoing in the air as in through the screen door of the Quonset office with a smell of Tide Flats come the coppers looking grim. Security, her magic word, her spell against demons. "Jess!" Shit, is he going to cry? He can feel it building like an orgasm. Who saves him, or interferes with his orgasm? Why, Jeremy himself. Old Beaver shows up and waves off the heat, who goes surly, fang-flashing back to masturbating into Crime Does Not Pay comics, gazing dreamy at guardroom pinups of J. Edgar Hoover, or whatever it was they were up to, and the romantic triangle are suddenly all to have lunch together at the club. Lunch together? Is this Noel Coward or some shit? Jessica, at the last minute, is overcome by some fictitious female syndrome which both men guess to be morning sickness. Roger figuring she'll do the most spiteful thing she can think of, Jeremy seeing it as a cute little private yoo-hoo for too-hoo. So that leaves the fellows alone to talk briskly about Operation Backfire, which is the British program to assemble some A-4s and fire them out into the North Sea. What else are they going to talk about? Why? Roger keeps asking, trying to piss Jeremy off. Why do you want to put them together and fire them? We've captured them, haven't we? What does one do with a rocket? But why? Why? Damn it, to see, obviously. Jessica tells me you're, a math chap. Little sigma times P of S over little sigma equals 1 over the square root of 2 pi times E to the minus S squared over 2 little sigma squared. Good Lord! Laughing, hastily checking out the room. It is an old saying among my people. Jeremy knows how to handle this. Roger is invited to dinner in the evening, an intimate, informal party at the home of Stefan Utgartaloki, an ex-member of management at the Krupp Works here in Cuxhaven. "You're welcome to bring a guest, of course," gnaws the eager Beaver. "There's a lot of snazzy naffies about. It wouldn't be too difficult for you to..." "Informal means lounge suit, eh?" interrupts Roger. Too bad he hasn't got one. The prospects of being nabbed tonight are good. A party that includes A, an Operation Backfire figure, B, a Krupp executive, must necessarily then include C, at least one ear to the corporate grapevine that's heard of the urinating incident in Clive Mossmoon's office. If Roger only knew what Beaver and his friends really have in mind. He does take a dean who has caused to be brought him from the Panama Canal Zone, where the lock workers wear them as a uniform in amazing tropical parrot combinations of yellow, green, lavender, vermilion, a zoot suit of unbelievable proportions. The pointed lapels have to be reinforced with because they extend so far outboard of the rest of the suit. Underneath his purple-on-purple satin shirt, the natty tar is actually wearing a corset, squeezing his waist into a sylph-like 42 inches to allow for the drastic suppression of the jacket, which then falls to Bodine's knees, quintuple-vented in yards of kilt-style pleats that run clear back up over his ass. The pants are belted under his armpits and pegged down to something like 10 inches, so he has to use hidden zippers to get his feet through. The whole suit is blue, not suit blue, no, really blue, paint blue. It is immediately noticed everywhere it goes. At gatherings, it haunts the peripheral vision, making decent small talk impossible. It is a suit that forces you either to reflect on matters as primary as its color or feel superficial. A subversive garment, all right. "Just you and me, partner?" says Bodine. Ain't that kind of cutting it a little close? Listen, Roger, chuckling unhealthily at what's also just occurred to him. We can't even bring those big rubber cocks along. Tonight we're going to have to use our wits. Tell you what, I'll just send a motorcycle out to Putsy's, round us up a goon squad, and... You know what? You've lost your sense of adventure. Yeah, you didn't used to be like this, you know. Look, old buddy, pronouncing it in Navy dialect, buddy. Come on, buddy, put yourself in my shoes. I might if they weren't that shade of yellow. Just a humble guy, the swarthy doughboy of the deep scratching in his groin after an elusive crab with a horn finger rippling the ballooning pleats and fabric of his trousers. Just a freckle-faced kid from Albert Lea, Minnesota, down there on Route 69 where the speed limit's lickety-split all night long. Just trying to make it in the zone here, kind of a freckle-faced kid used a safety pin through a cork for a cat whisker and stayed up, listened to the voices coast to coast before I was 10, and none of them ever recommended getting into any of them gang wars, buddy. Be glad you're still so fucking naive, Rog. Where did you see your first European gangster hit? They like to use 3 rounds, head, stomach, and heart. You dig that stomach? Over here, stomach's no second-class organ, partner, and that's a good autumn kind of thought to keep in mind. Bodine, didn't you desert? That's a death sentence, isn't it? Shit, I can square that, but I'm only a cog. Don't go thinking I know everything. All I know is my trade. I can show you how to wash coke and assay it. I can feel a gem and tell you from the temperature if it's a fake. The fake won't suck as much heat from your body. Glass is a reluctant vampire, ancient dealers saying. Hey, and I can spot funny money easy as E on an eye chart. I got one of the best visual memories in the zone. So, Roger drags him off, monologuing in his zoot suit to the crook wingding. Coming in the door, first thing Bodine notices is this string quartet that's playing tonight. The second violin happens to be Gustav Schlabon, Zoyre Boomer's frequent unwelcome doping partner, Captain Horror, as he is affectionately but not inaccurately known around their plots. And playing viola is Gustav's accomplice in suicidally depressing everybody inside 100 meters radius, wherever they drop in. Who's that tapping and giggling at your door, Fred and Phyllis? Andrei Amnopan of the feathery Rilke mustaches and porky pig tattoo on stomach, which is becoming the hip thing lately. Even back in the zone of the interior, the American subdebs all think it's swoony. Gustav and Andrei are the inner voices tonight, which is especially odd because on the program is the suppressed quartet from the Haydn Opus 76, the so-called Kazoo Quartet in G-flat minor, which gets its name from the Largo Cantabile e Mesto movement, in which the inner voices are called to play kazoos instead of their usual instruments, creating problems of dynamics for cello and first violin that are unique in the literature. You actually need to shift in places from a spittato to a détaché, Bodine rapidly talking a corporate wife of some sort across the room toward the free lunch table piled with lobster hors d'oeuvres and capon sandwiches. Less bow, higher up, you understand, soften it. Then there's also about 1,000 pianissimo to fortissimo blasts, but only the one, the notorious one, going the other way. Indeed, one reason for the work's suppression in this subversive use of sudden fortissimo quieting to pianissimo, it's the touch of the wandering sound shadow, the Brennschluss of the sun. They don't want you listening to too much of that stuff, at least not the way Haydn presents it, a strange lapse in the revered composer's behavior. Cello, violin, alto, and treble kazoos, all rollicking along in a tune, sounds like a song from the movie Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You should see me dance the polka, when suddenly, in the middle of an odd bar, the kazoos just stop completely. And the outer voices fall to plucking a non-melody that tradition says represents 2 18th-century village idiots vibrating their lower lips at each other. It goes on for 20-40 bars, this Phoebe's pizzicato, middle-line croupsters creak in the bow-legged velvet chairs, be-ba-ba-be-ba-ba, this does not sound like Haydn, Mutti. Reps from ICI and GE angle their heads, trying to read in the candlelight the little programs lovingly hand-lettered by Utgard Taloki's partner in life, Frau Utgard Taloki, nobody is certain what her first name is, which is ever so much help to Stefan because it keeps them all on the defensive with her. She is a blonde image of your mother dead. If you have ever seen her, travestied in beaten gold, the cheeks curving too far, deformed, the eyebrows too dark and whites too white, some zero indifference that in the end is truly evil in the way they've distorted her face, then you know the look. Nalin Slothrop just before her first martini is right here, in spirit, at this Krupfest. So is her son Tyrone, but only because by now, early Virgo, he has become one plucked albatross. Plucked, hell, stripped, scattered all over the zone. It's doubtful if he can ever be found again, in the conventional sense of positively identified and detained. Only feathers, redundant or regenerable organs, which we would be tempted to classify under the Hydra phenomenon were it not for the complete absence of hostility. Natasha Raum, Regions of Indeterminacy in Albatross Anatomy. Proceedings of the International Society of Confessors to an Enthusiasm for Albatross Nosology. Winter, 1936. Great little magazine. They actually sent a correspondent to Spain that winter to cover that. There are issues devoted entirely to analyses of world economics, all clearly relevant to problems of albatross nosology. Does so-called nightworm belong among the pseudo-Goldstrassian group, or is it properly considered, indications being almost identical, a more insidious form of Mops hebdomeriasis? Well, if the conference knew better what those categories concealed, they might be in a better position to disarm, depenis, and dismantle the man. But they don't. Actually, they do, but they don't admit it. Sad, but true. They are as schizoid, as double-minded in the massive presence of money as any of the rest of us, and that's the hard fact. The man has a branch office in each of our brains. His corporate emblem is a white albatross. Each local rep has a cover known as the ego, and their mission in this world is bad shit. We do know what's going on, and we let it go on. As long as we can see them, stare at them, those massively moneyed once in a while, as long as they allow us a glimpse, however rarely, we need that. And how they know it, how often, under what conditions, we ought to be seeing much popular magazine coverage on the order of the night Rod and Beaver fought over Jessica while she cried in Krupp's arms and drooled over every blurry photo. Roger must have been dreaming for a minute here of the sweaty evenings of Thermidor, the failed counterforce, the glamorous ex-rebels, half suspected but still enjoying official immunity and sly love, camera-worthy wherever they carry on, doomed pet freaks. They will use us. We will help legitimize them, though they don't need it, really. It's another dividend for them, nice but not critical. Oh, yes, isn't that exactly what they'll do? Bringing Roger now at a less than appropriate time and place here in the bosom of the opposition, while his life's first authentic love is squirming only to get home and take another wad of Jeremy's sperm so they'll make their day's quota. In the middle of all that, he has to walk, ow, fuck, right into the interesting question, which is worse, living on as their pet or death? It is not a question he has ever imagined himself asking seriously. It has come by surprise, but there's no sending it away now. He really does have to decide, and soon enough, plausibly soon, to feel the terror in his bowels. Terror he cannot think away. He has to choose between his life and his death. Letting it sit for a while is no compromise, but a decision to live on their terms. The viola is a ghost, grainy brown, translucent, sighing in and out of the other voices. Dynamic shifts abound, imperceptible lifts, platooning notes together or preparing for changes in loudness, what the Germans call breath pauses, skitter among the phrases. Perhaps tonight it is due to the playing of Gustav and André, but after a while the listener starts actually hearing the pauses instead of the notes. His ear gets tickled the way your eye does staring at a reco map until bomb craters flip inside out to become muffins risen above the tin, or ridges fold to valleys, sea and land flicker across quicksilver edges. So the silences dance in this quartet, and wait till those kazoos come on. That's the background music for what is to transpire. The plot against Roger has been formulated with shivering and giddy glee. Seaman Bodine is an unexpected bonus. Going into dinner becomes a priestly procession full of secret gestures and understandings. It is a very elaborate meal, according to the menu, full of relevés, poissons, entremets. What's this Überraschungbraten here? Seaman Bodine asks right-hand dinner companion Constance Flamp, loose-cockied newshound and tough-talking sweetheart of every G.I. from Iwo to St. Lo. Why, just what it says, Boats, replies Commando Connie. That's German for surprise roast. I'm hep, says Bodine. She has, maybe not meaning to, gestured with her eyes. Perhaps, pointsman, there is such a thing as the kindness reflex. How many young men has she seen go down since 42? That now and then also beyond the zero survives extinction. Bodine looks down at the far end of the table, past corporate teeth and polished fingernails, past heavy monogrammed eating tools, and for the first time notices a stone barbecue pit with two black iron hand-operated spits. Servants in their pre-war livery are busy layering scrap paper, old chafe directives mostly, kindlings and coal, luscious fist-sized raven chunks of the kind that once left bodies up and down the sides of the canals once during the inflation, when it was actually held that mortally dear, imagine. At the edge of the pit, with Justice about to light the taper, as Gretchen daintily laces the fuel with GI xylene from down in the dockyards, Seaman Bodine observes Roger's head being held by four or six hands upside down, the lips being torn away from the teeth and the high gums already draining white as a skull, while one of the maids, a classic satin and lace impish torturable young maid, brushes the teeth with American toothpaste, carefully scrubbing away the nicotine stains and tartar. Roger's eyes are so hurt. All around, guests are whispering, "How quaint Stefan's even thought of head cheese." "Oh, no, it's another part I'm waiting to get my teeth in," giggles, heavy breathing. "And what's that pair of very blue peg pants all ripped? And what's this staining the jacket? And what, up on the spit, reddening to a fat glazed crust, is turning, whose face is about to come rotating around? Why, it's..." "No ketchup, no ketchup," the hirsute blue jacket, searching agitatedly among the cruets and salvers. "Seems to be no... What the fuck kind of a place is this, Raj?" yelling down slantwise across seven enemy faces. "Hey, buddy, you find any ketchup down there?" "Ketchup's a code word. Okay." "Odd," replies Roger, who clearly has seen exactly the same thing down at the pit. "I was just about to ask you the same question." They are grinning at each other like fools. Their auras, for the record, are green. No shit. Not since winter of 42, in convoy in a North Atlantic gale, with accidental tons of loose 5-inch ammo rolling all over the ship, the German wolf pack invisibly knocking off sister ships right and left, at battle stations inside Mount 51 listening to the pappy hod tell disaster jokes, really funny ones, the whole gun crew clutching their stomachs hysterically gasping for air. Not since then has Seaman Bodine felt so high in the good chances of death. "Some layout, huh?" he calls. "Pretty good food." Conversation has fallen nearly silent. Politely curious faces are turning, flames leap in the pit. They are not sensitive flames, but if they were, they might be able now to detect the presence of Brigadier Pudding. He is now a member of the counterforce, courtesy of Carol Eventyr. Courtesy is right. Seances with Pudding are at least as trying as the old weekly briefings back at the White Visitation. Pudding has even more of a mouth on him than he did alive. The sitters have begun to whine, "Aren't we ever to be rid of him?" But it is through Pudding's devotion to culinary prankdom that the repulsive stratagem that follows was devised. "Oh, I don't know," Roger elaborately casual. "I can't seem to find any snot soup on the menu." "Yeah, I could have done with some of that pus pudding myself. Think there'll be any of that?" "No, but there might be a scum souffle," cries Roger, "with a side of menstrual marmalade." "Well, I've got eyes for some of that rich, meaty smegma stew," suggests Bodine. "Or how about a clot casserole?" "I say," murmurs a voice, indeterminate as to sex, down the table. "We could plan a better meal than this," Roger, waving the menu. "Start off with afterbirth appetizers. Perhaps some clever little scab sandwiches with the crusts trimmed off, of course. Or booger biscuits. Yes, spread with mucus mayonnaise and topped with a succulent bit of slime sausage." "Oh, I see," says Commando Connie. "It has to be alliterative. How about, discharge dumplings?"
"We're doing the soup course, babe," says cool Seaman Bodine. "So let me just suggest a canker consomme or perhaps a barf bouillon."
Vomit vichyssoise, says Connie.
You got it.
Cyst salad, Roger continues, with little cheery red squares of abortion aspic tossed in a subtle dandruff dressing.
There is a sound of well-bred gagging, and a regional sales manager for ICI leaves hurriedly, spewing the long crescent of lumpy beige vomit that splatters across the parquetry. Napkins are being raised to faces all down the table. Silverware is being laid down, silver ringing the fields of white, a puzzling indecision here again, the same as at Clive Mossmoon's office. On we go through fart fondue, skillfully placed bubbles of anal gas rising slowly, through a rich cheese viscosity, yum, boil blintzes, vegetables venereal in slobber sauce. A kazoo stops playing.
Wart waffles! Gustav screams.
Puke pancakes with sweat syrup, adds André Omnipon, as Gustav resumes playing, the outer voices meantime having broken off in confusion.
And spread with pinwerves, murmurs the cellist, who is not above a bit of fun.
Hemorrhoid hash, Connie banging her spoon in delight. Bowel burgers!
Frau Utgartaloki jumps to her feet, upsetting a platter of stuffed sores, beg pardon, no, they're deviled eggs, and runs from the room, sobbing tragically. Her suave metal husband also rises and follows, casting back at the troublemakers virile stares that promise certain death. A discreet smell of vomit has begun to rise through the hanging tablecloth. Nervous laughter has long embrittled to bad-mouth whispering.
A choice of gangrene goulash or some scrumptious, creamy white leprosy loaf, light sing-song. Leprosy, down a third to loaf, playfully hounding the holdouts, shaking a finger. Come on, you little rascals, vomit for the nice zootster.
Fungus fricassee, screams Roger the rowdy. Jessica is weeping on the arm of Jeremy, her gentleman, who is escorting her, stiff-armed, shakes head at Roger's folly away forever.
Does Roger have a second of pain right here?
Yes, sure, you would too. You might even question the worth of your cause, but there are nose-pick noodles to be served up buttery and steaming, grime gruel and pustule porridge to be ladled into the bowls of a sniveling generation of future executives, pubic popovers to be wheeled out onto the terraces stained by Holocaust sky or growing rigid with autumn.
Carbuncle cutlets with groin gravy and ringworm relish.
Lady Nemosyne Gloob is having a seizure of some kind, so violent that her pearls break and go rattling down the silk tablecloth. A general loss of appetite reigns, not to mention overt nausea. The flames in the pit have dwindled. No fat to feed them tonight. Sir Hannibal Grunt Gobinet is threatening, between spasms of yellow bile foaming out his nose, to bring the matter up in Parliament.
"I'll see you two in the scrubs if it kills me."
Well... A gentle, precarious soft shoe out the door, Bodine waving his wide-brim gangster hat.
Ta-ta, folks. The only guest still seated is Constance Flamp, who is still roaring out dessert possibilities. Crotch custard, phlegm fudge, mold muffins.
Will she catch hell tomorrow? Pools of this and that glitter across the floor like water mirages at the sixth antechamber to the throne.
Gustav and the rest of the quartet have abandoned Haydn and are all following Roger and Bodine out the door, kazoos and strings accompanying the disgusting duo.
Oh, gimme some of that acne a la mode. Eat so much that odd jests explode. Say there, buddy, you can chow all night on toad jam tarts and diarrhea delight.
I have to tell you. Gustav whispering speedily, I feel so awful about it, but perhaps you don't want people like me. You see, I was a stormtrooper a long time ago, you know, like Horst Wessel.
So? Bodine's laughing. Maybe I was a Melvin Purvis Jr. G-man.
A what?
For post-toasties.
For whom?
The German actually thinks post-toasties is the name of some American Führer looking vaguely like Tom Mix or some other such long-lip bridal-jaw cowboy.
The last black butler opens the last door to the outside and escape. Escape tonight.
Pimple pie with filth frosting, gentlemen,
he nods. And just at the other side of dawning, you can see a smile.
In her pack,
gaily tripping, brings along a few of Chicherina's toenail clippings, a graying hair, a piece of bedsheet with a trace of his sperm, all tied in a white kerchief, next to a bit of Adam and Eve root and a loaf of bread baked from wheat she has rolled naked in and ground against the sun. She has left off tending her herd of toads on the witch's hillsides and has passed her white wand to another apprentice. She is off to find her gallant Attila. Now there are a good few hundred of these young women in the zone who are smitten with love for Chicherine, all of them sharp as foxes, but none quite as stubborn as Gailey, and none are witches. At noon, she comes to a farmhouse with a floor of blue and white tiles in the kitchen, elaborate old china plates hung like pictures, and a rocking chair. "Do you have a photo of him?" the old woman handing her a tin army plate with the remains of her morning's Bauernfrühstück. "I can give you a spell. Sometimes I can call up his face in a cup of tea, but the herbs have to be gathered carefully. I'm not that good at it yet." "But you're in love. Technique is just a substitute for when you get older. Why not stay in love always?" The two women watch each other across the sunny kitchen. Cabinets with glass panes shine from the walls. Bees buzz outside the windows. Gailey goes and pumps water from the well, and they brew some strawberry leaf tea, but Chicherina's face doesn't appear. The night the blacks started off on their great trek, Nordhausen felt like a city in a myth, under the threat of some special destruction, engulfment by a crystal lake, lava from the sky. For an evening, the sense of preservation there was lost. The blacks, like the rockets in the Mittelwerke, had given Nordhausen continuity. Now the blacks are gone. Gailey knows they are on collision course with Chicherine. She doesn't want duels. Let the university boys duel. She wants her graying steel barbarian alive. She can't bear to think that she may already have touched him, felt his scarred and historied hands for the last time. Behind, pushing her, is the town's somnolence, and at night, the strange canaried knights of the hearts. The hustlers are busy shooting up female birds with male hormones, so they'll sing long enough to be sold to the foreign suckers who occupy the zone. Full of too many spells, witch rivalries, coven politics, she knows that's not what magic is about. The Hexenstadt, with its holy mountains cropped in pale circles all up pieces by the little tethered goats, has turned into just another where the only enterprise is administrating. There is of upstairs at the musicians' union no music, just glass brick partitions, spittoons, indoor plants, no practicing which is left. You either come to the Brocken complex with a bureaucratic career in mind, or you leave it and choose the world. There are the two distinct sorts of witch, and Gailey is the world-choosing sort. Here is the world. She is wearing gray men's trousers rolled to the knee that flap around her thighs as she walks by the rye fields, walking with her head down, pushing hair out of her eyes often. Sometimes soldiers come by and give her rides. She listens for news of Chicherine, of the trekking Schwarzkommando. If it feels right, she will even ask about Chicherine. The variety of the rumors surprises her. "I'm not the only one who loves him." Though their love, of course, is friendly, admiring, unsexual. Gailey's the only one in the zone who loves him completely. Chicherine, known in some circles as the Red Doper, is about to be purged. The emissary is none other and Beria's top man, the sinister N. Ripoff himself. Bullshit. Chicherny's already dead. Didn't you hear? He's been dead for months. They've had somebody impersonating him till all the others in his block are taken care of. No, he came into Lüneburg last weekend. My mate's seen him before. No mistake, it's him. He's lost a lot of weight and takes a heavy bodyguard everywhere he goes. At least a dozen. Orientals mostly. Fully equipped with Judas Iscariot, no doubt. That one's hard to believe. A dozen? Where does anybody find that many people he can trust, especially out at the edge like he is? What edge? They're rattling along in the back of a 2.5-ton lorry through green, rolling country. A storm is blowing up mute purple, veined in yellow, behind them. Bailey's been drinking wine with the scurvy lot of Tommies, a demolition squad who've been out all day clearing canals. They smell of creosote, marsh mud, ammonia from the dynamite. Well, you know what he's doing. The rockets? I wouldn't want to be in his place, that's all. Up on the crest of a hill, an army surveying party is restoring a damaged road. One silhouette leans, peering through a transit. One holds a bob. A bit apart from the instrument man, another engineer stands with his arms out straight to the sides. His head moves, sighting along either pointed land, then the arms swoop together. If you close your eyes and have learned to let your arms move by themselves, your fingers will touch, making a perfect right angle from where they were. Gailey watches the tiny act. It is devotional, graceful, and she feels the cross the man has made on his own circle of visible earth. Unconsciously, a mandala. It is a sign for her. He is pointing her on her way. Later that evening, she sees an eagle flying across the marshes in the same direction. It's golden dark, almost night. The region is lonely, and Pan is very close. Gailey has been to enough Sabbaths to handle it, she thinks. But what is a devil's blue bite on the ass to the shrieking outward into stone resonance where there is no good or evil out in the luminous spaces Pan will carry her to? Is she ready yet for anything so real? The moon has risen. She sits now at the same spot where she saw the eagle, waiting, waiting for something to come and take her. Have you ever waited for it, wondering whether it will come from outside or inside? Finally past the futile guesses at what might happen, now and then re-erasing brain to keep it clean for the visit. Yes, wasn't it close to here? Remember, didn't you sneak away from camp to have a moment alone with what you felt stirring across the land? It was the equinox. Green spring equal nights. Canyons are opening up. At the bottom, they're steaming fumaroles, steaming the tropical life there like greens in a pot, rank dope perfume, a hood of smell. Human consciousness, that poor cripple, that deformed and doomed thing is about to be born. This is the world just before men. Too violently pitched, alive, in constant flow, ever to be seen by men directly. They are meant only to look at it dead, in still strata, transputrefied to oil or coal. Alive, it was a threat. It was Titans. Was an overpeaking of life so clangorous and mad, such a green corona about Earth's body that some spoiler had to be brought in before it blew the creation apart. So we, the crippled keepers, were sent out to multiply, to have dominion. God's spoilers. Us. Counter-revolutionaries. It is our mission to promote death. The way we kill, the way we die, being unique among the creatures. It was something we had to work on, historically and personally, to build from scratch up to its present status as reaction, nearly as strong as life, holding down the green uprising, but only nearly as strong, only nearly because of the defection rate. A few keep going over to the Titans every day in their striving sub-creation. How can flesh tumble and flow so and never be any less beautiful? Into the rests of the folk song, death, empty stone rooms, out and through and down under the net, down to the uprising. In harsh-edged echo, Titans stir far below. They are all the presences we are not supposed to be seeing. Wind gods, hilltop gods, sunset gods, that we train ourselves away from to keep from looking further, even though enough of us do, leave their electric voices behind in the twilight at the edge of the town and move into the constantly parted cloak of our night walk till suddenly Pan, leaping, its face too beautiful to bear, beautiful serpent, its coils in rainbow lashings in the sky, into the sure bones of fright. Don't walk home at night through the empty country. Don't go into the forest when the light is too low, even too late in the afternoon. It will get you. Don't sit by the tree like this with your cheek against the bark. It is impossible in this moonlight to see if you are male or female now. Your hair spills silver white. Your body under the gray cloth is so exactly vulnerable, so fated to degradation time and again. What if he wakes and finds you've gone? He is now always the same, awake or asleep. He never leaves the single dream. There are no more differences between the worlds. They have become one for him. Thanatos and Margarita may have been his last ties with the old. That may be why they stayed so long. It was his desperation. He wanted to hold on. He needed them. But when he looks at them now,
he doesn't see them as often anymore. They are also losing what reality they brought here, as Gottfried lost all of his to Blissero long ago. Now the boy moves image to image, room to room, sometimes out of the action, sometimes part of it. Whatever he has to do, he does. The day has its logic, its needs. No way for him to change it, leave it, or live outside it. He is helpless. He is sheltered, secure. It's only a matter of weeks and everything will be over. Germany will have lost the war. The routines go on. The boy cannot imagine anything past the last surrender. If he and Blissero are separated, what will happen to the flow of days? Will Blissero die? No, please don't let him die. But he will. "You're going to survive me," he whispers. Gottfried kneels at his feet, wearing the dog collar. Both are in army clothes. It's a long time since either of them dressed as a woman. It is important tonight that they both be men. "Ah, you're so smug, you little bastard." "It is only another game, isn't it? Another excuse for a whipping?" Gottfried keeps silent. When Blissero wants an answer, he says so. It happens often that he only wants to talk, and that may go on for hours. No one has ever talked to Gottfried before, not like this. His father uttered only commands, sentences, flat judgments. His mother was emotional, a great flow of love. Frustration and secret terror passed into him from her, but they never really talked. This is so more than real. He feels he must keep every word, that none must be lost. Blissero's words have become precious to him. He understands that Blissero wants to give without expecting anything back, give away what he loves. He believes that he exists for Blissero, even if the others have all ceased to. That in the new kingdom they pass through now, he is the only other living inhabitant. Was it this he expected to be taken by, taken into? Glycero's seed sputtering into the poisoned manure of his bowels. It is waste, yes, futility, but as man and woman, coupled, are shaken to the teeth at their approaches to the gates of life, hasn't he also felt more, worshipfully more, past these arrangements for penetration, the style, garments of flaying without passion, sheer hosiery perishable as the skin of a snake, custom manacles and chains to stand for the bondage he feels in his heart. All become theater as he approached the gates of that other kingdom, felt the white gigantic muzzles somewhere inside, expressionless beasts frozen white, pushing him away, the crust and mantle hum of mystery so beyond his poor hearing. There have to be these two. Lovers whose genitals are consecrated to shit, to endings, to the desperate nights in the streets when connection proceeds out of all personal control, proceeds or fails, a gathering of fallen, as many in acts of death as in acts of life, or a sentence to be alone for another night. Are they to be denied, passed over, all of them? On his approaches to it, taken inward again and again, Gottfried can only try to keep himself open, to loosen the sphincter of his soul. "And sometimes I dream of discovering the edge of the world, finding that there is an end. My mountain gentian always knew, but it has cost me so much." America was the edge of the world, a message for Europe, continent-sized, inescapable. Europe had found the site for its kingdom of death, that special death the West had invented. Savages had their waste regions, Kalaharis, lakes so misty they could not see the other side, but Europe had gone deeper, into obsession, addiction, away from all the savage innocences. America was a gift from the invisible power, the way of returning, but Europe refused it. It wasn't Europe's original sin. The latest name for that is modern analysis, but it happens that subsequent sin is harder to atone for. In Africa, Asia, Amerindia, Oceania, Europe came and established its order of analysis and death. What it could not use, it killed or altered. In time, the death colonies grew strong enough to break away, but the impulse to empire, the mission to propagate death,
the structure of it kept on. Now we are in the last phase. American death has come to occupy Europe. It has learned empire from its old metropolis, but now we have only the structure left us. None of the great rainbow plumes, no fittings of gold, no epic marches over alkali seas. The savages of other continents, corrupted but still resisting in the name of life, have gone on despite everything, while death and Europe are separate as ever, their love still unconsummated. Death only rules here. It has never, in love, become one with. Is the cycle over now and a new one ready to begin? Will our new edge, our new death kingdom, be the moon? I dream of a great glass sphere, hollow and very high and far away. The colonists have learned to do without air, its vacuum inside and out. It's understood the men won't ever return. They are all men. There are ways for getting back, but so complicated, so at the mercy of language, that presence back on Earth is only temporary and never real. Passages out there are dangerous, chances of falling so shining and deep. Gravity rules all the way out to the cold sphere. There is always the danger of falling. Inside the colony, the handful of men have a frosty appearance, hardly solid, no more alive than memories, nothing to touch, only their remote images, black and white film images, grained, broken year after hoarfrost year out in the white latitudes, in empty colony, with only infrequent visits from the accidental, like me. I wish I could recover it all. Those men had once been through a tragic day, ascent, fire, failure, blood. The events of that day so long ago had put them into exile forever. No, they weren't really spacemen. Out here, they wanted to dive between the worlds, to fall, turn, reach, and swing on journeys curved through the shining, through the winter nights of space. Their dreams were of rendezvous, of cosmic trapeze acts, carried on in loneliness, in sterile grace, in certain knowledge that no one would ever be watching, that loved ones had been lost forever. The connections they hoped for would always miss by trillions of dark miles, by years of frozen silence. But I wanted to bring you back the story. I remember that you used to whisper me to sleep with stories of us one day living on the moon. Are you beyond that by now? You've got much older. Can you feel in your body how strongly I have infected you with my dying? I was meant to. When a certain time has come, I think that we are all meant to. Fathers are carriers of the virus of death. And sons are the infected. And, so that the infection may be more certain, death in its ingenuity has contrived to make the father and son beautiful to each other as life has made male and female. Oh, Gottfried, of course, yes, you are beautiful to me, but I'm dying. I want to get through it as honestly as I can, and your immortality rips at my heart. Can't you see why I might want to destroy that, oh, that stupid clarity in your eyes, when I see you in morning and evening ranks, so open, so ready to take my sickness in and shelter it inside your own little ignorant love? Your love. He nods several times. But his eyes are too dangerously spaced beyond the words, stunned irreversibly away from real Gottfried, away from the weak, the failed smells of real breath, by barriers stern and clear as ice, and hopeless as the one-way flow of European time. I want to break out, to leave this cycle of infection and death. I want to be taken in love, so taken that you and I and death and life will be gathered inseparable into the radiance of what we would become. Gottfried kneels, numb, waiting. Glycero is looking at him, deeply, his face whiter than the boy has ever seen it. A raw spring wind beats the canvas of their tent. It's near sunset. In a moment, Glycero must go out to take evening reports. His hands rest near a mound of cigarette butts in a mess tray. His myopic witch's eyes, through the thick lenses, may be looking into Gottfried's for the first time. Gottfried cannot look away. He knows, somehow, incompletely, that he has a decision to make, that Glycero expects something from him. But Glycero has always made the decisions. Why is he suddenly asking? It all poises here. Passageways of routine, still cogent enough, still herding us through time. The iron rockets waiting outside. The birth scream of the latest spring torn across rainy miles of Saxony. Root sides littered with last envelopes, stripped gears, seized bearings, rotted socks and skivvies fragrant now with fungus and mud. If there is still hope for Gottfried here in this wind-beat moment, then there is hope elsewhere. The scene itself must be read as a card. What is to come? Whatever has happened since to the figures in it, roughly drawn in soiled white, army gray, spare as a sketch on a ruined wall, it is preserved, though it has no name. And, like the fool, no agreed assignment in the deck. Here's Ensign ramrodding his brand new rocket through the night. When it rains, when the mist is heavy, before the watch can quite get tarps over, the glossy skin of the rocket is seen to have turned to dark slate. Perhaps, after all, just before the firing, it will be painted black. It is the 00001, the second in its series. Russian loudspeakers across the Elbe have called to you. American rumors have come driving into the fires at night and summoned against the ground of your hopes the yellow American deserts, red Indians, blue sky, green cactus. How did you feel about the old rocket? Not now that it's giving you job security, but back then. Do you remember any more what it was wheeling them out by hand, a dozen of you that morning, a guard of encounter of your bodies with its inertia? All your faces drowning in the same selfless look. The moires of personality softening, each sweep of surf a little more out of focus till all has become subtle grades of cloud. All hatred, all love, wiped away for the short distance that could push it over the winter berm. Aging men in coat skirts flapping below your boot tops, breaths in white spouts breaking turbulent as the waves behind you. Where will you all go? What empires, what deserts? You caressed its body, brute, freezing through your gloves. Here together without shame or reticence, you 12 struggled in love on this Baltic shore. Not Peenemünde, perhaps, not official Peenemünde, but once, years ago, boys in white skirts and dark vests and caps, on some beach, a children's resort, when we were younger. At test stand 7, the image at last, you couldn't leave, the way the wind smelled salt and dying, the sound of winter surf, the premonition of rain you could feel at the back of your neck stirring in the clipped hairs. At test stand 7, the holy place. But young men have all grown older, and there's little color in the scene. They are pushing into the sun, the glare strikes them squinting and grinning. Bright here is the morning shift at Siemens with the centaurs struggling high on the wall, the clock without numerals. Bicycles squeaking, lunch pails and lunch bags in the lowered faces of the trudging, dutiful streams of men and women into the dark openings. It resembles a daguerreotype taken of early Raketenstadt by a forgotten photographer in 1856. This is the picture, in fact, that killed him. He died a week later from mercury poisoning after inhaling fumes of the heated metal in his studio. Well, he was a habitué of mercury fumes in moderate doses. He felt it did his brain some good, and that may account for pictures like Der Raketenstadt. It shows, from a height that is topographically impossible in Germany, the ceremonial city, fourfold as expected, an eerie precision to all lines and shadings, architectural and human, built in mandalic form like a Herero village. Overhead a magnificent sky, marble carried to a wildness of white billow and candescence. There seems to be building or demolition underway in various parts of the city, for nothing here remains the same. We can see the sweat in individual drops on the workers' dark necks as they struggle down the bone-damp cellars. A bag of cement has broken, and its separate motes hang in the light. The city will always be changing. New tire treads in the dust, new cigarette wrappers in the garbage. Engineering changes to the rocket create new routes of supply, new living arrangements, reflected in traffic densities as viewed from this unusual height. There are indeed tables of functions to get from such city changes to rocket modifications, no more than an extension, really, of the techniques by which Constance Babington Smith and her colleagues at RAF Medmenham discovered the rocket back in 1943 in Recco photographs of Peenemünde. But remember if you loved it. If you did, how you loved it. And how much. After all, you're used to asking how much, used to measuring, to comparing measurements, putting them into equations to find out how much more, how much of, how much when. And here, in your common drive to the sea, feel as much as you wish of that dark, double-minded love, which is also shame, bravado, engineers' geopolitics, spheres of influence, modified to toruses of rocket range that are parabolic in section. Not, as we might imagine, bounded below by the line of the earth it rises from and the earth it strikes. No, but then you never really thought it was, did you? Of course it begins infinitely below the earth and goes on infinitely back into the earth. It's only the peak that we are allowed to see. The breakup through the surface, out of the other silent world, violently. A jet airplane crashing into faster than sound. Some years later, a spaceship crashing into faster than light. Remember, the password in the zone this week is faster than the speed of light, speeding up your voice exponentially. Linear exceptions made only in case of upper respiratory complaints. At each end, understand, a very large transfer of energy, breaking upward into this world, a controlled burning, breaking downward again, an uncontrolled explosion. This lack of symmetry leads to speculating that a presence analogous to the ether flows through time, as the ether flows through space. The assumption of a vacuum in time tended to cut us off one from another, but an ether sea to bear us world to world might bring us back a continuity, show us a kinder universe, more easygoing. So, yes, yes, this is a scholasticism here, rocket state cosmology. The rocket does lead that way, among others, past these visible serpent coils that lash up above the surface of Earth in rainbow light, in steel tetany, these storms, these things of Earth's deep breast we were never told, past them through the violence to a numbered cosmos, a quaint brown wood-paneled Victorian kind of brain war, as between quaternions and vector analysis in the 1880s. The nostalgia of ether, the silver, pendulumed, stone-anchored, knurled, brass, filigreed, elegantly functional shapes of your grandfathers. These sepia tones are here, certainly, but the rocket has to be many things. It must answer to a number of different shapes in the dreams of those who touch it. In combat, in tunnel, on paper, it must survive heresies, shining, unconfoundable, and heretics there will be. Gnostics, who have been taken in a rush of wind and fire to chambers of the rocket throne. Kabbalists, who study the rocket as Torah, letter by letter, rivets, burner cap, and brass rose. Its text is theirs to permute and combine into new revelations, always unfolding. Manichaeans who see two rockets, good and evil, who speak together in the sacred ideolalia of the primal twins. Some say their names are Enzian and Vicero, of a good rocket to take us to the stars, an evil rocket for the world's suicide. The two perpetually in struggle. But these heretics will be sought, and the dominion of silence will enlarge as each one goes down. They will all be sought out. Each will have his personal rocket. Stored in its target seeker will be the heretic's EEG, the spikes and susurrations of heartbeat, the ghost blossomings of personal infrared. Each rocket will know its intended and hunt him, ride him a green, doped and silent hound through our world, shining and pointed in the sky at his back, his guardian, executioner rushing in, rushing closer. Here are the objectives. To make the run over tracks that may end abruptly at riverside or in carbonized train yard, over roads even the unpaved alternates to which are patrolled now by Russian and British and American troops in a hardening occupation. a fear of winter bleaching the men all more formal into braces of attention they ignored during the summer, closer adherence now to the paperwork as colors of trees and brush begin their change, as purple blurs out over miles of heath and nights come sooner. To have to stay out in the rains of early Virgo, the children who stowed away on the trek against all orders are down now with coughs and fevers. Sniffling at night, hoarse little voices inside oversized uniform jackets. To brew tea for them from fennel, betony, wits and roses, sunflowers, mallow leaves. To loot sulfur drugs and penicillin. To avoid raising road dust when the sun has dried the ruts and crowns again by noon. To sleep in the fields. To hide the rocket sections under haystacks, behind the single wall of a gutted railroad shed, among rainy willows down beside the riverbeds. To disperse at any alarm, or often at random just for drill, to flow like a net down out of the hearts, up the ravines, sleeping in the dry, glazed spaces of deserted spas, official pain, official death watching all night from the porcelain eyes of statues. Digging these perimeters, smelling pine needles, boots, and trench shovels have crushed, to keep faith that it is not trek this time, nor struggle, but the destiny. 0001 sliding like an oiled bolt into the receivership of the railway system prepared for it last spring, a route only apparently in ruins, carefully crafted by the war by special techniques of bombardment to take this most immaculate of techniques, the rocket, this most terribly potential of bombardments. The 0001 goes disassembled in sections, warhead, guidance, fuel and oxidizer tanks, tail section. If they all make it to the firing site, it will have to be put back together there. Show me the society that never said I am created among men. Christian walks with Enzian in the fields above the encampment, to protect you each from violence, to give shelter in time of disaster. But Enzian, what protection is there? What can protect us from that? Gesturing down the valley at the yellow-gray camouflage netting they can both, x-ray-eyed for this one journey, see through. Enzian and the younger man somehow have drifted into long walks, nothing deliberate on either side. Is this how successions occur? Each man is suspicious, but there are no more of the old uncomfortable silences, no competing. It comes as the revealer, showing that no society can protect, never could. They are as foolish as shields of paper. He must tell Christian everything he knows, everything he suspects or has dreamed, proclaiming none of it for truth. But he must keep nothing back for him. Nothing is his to keep. They have lied to us. They can't keep us from dying, so they lie to us about death. A cooperative structure of lies. What have they ever given us in return for the trust, the love? They actually say love, we're supposed to owe them. Can they keep us from even catching cold, from lice, from being alone, from anything? Before the rocket we went on believing because we wanted to, but the rocket can penetrate from the sky at any given point. Nowhere is safe. We can't believe them anymore, not if we are still sane and love the truth. We are, nods Christian. We do. He isn't looking at anything to confirm it either. Yes. Then, in the absence of faith. One night, in the rain, their lager stops for the night at a deserted research station where the Germans, close to the end of the war, whipping a sonic death mirror. Tall paraboloids of concrete staggered, white and monolithic, across the plain. The idea was to set off an explosion in front of the paraboloid at the exact focal point. The concrete mirror would then throw back a perfect shockwave to destroy anything in its path. Thousands of guinea pigs, dogs, and cows were experimentally blasted to death here. Reams of death-curved data were compiled. But the project was a lemon, only good at short range, and you rapidly aim to a fall-off point where the amount of explosives well be deployed some other way. Fog, wind, hardly visible ripples or snags in the terrain, anything less than perfect conditions, could ruin the shockwave's deadly shape. Still, Enzian can envision a war, a place for them, a desert. Lure your enemy to a desert, Tlahari, wait for the wind to die. Who would fight for a desert? Katya wants to know. She's wearing a hooded green slicker, looks even too big for Ensign.
In.
Christian jotting down, looking up at the pale curve of reflector they've come to the base of and have gathered at in the rain, sharing a smoke, taking a moment away from the rest of the trek. What he's saying is in. Saves trouble later if you can get the texts straight soon as they're spoken. Thank you, says Oberst Ensign. 100 meters away, a gray tanker jacket. Out of its pocket, eyes. It is fat lemming Ursula. All and despite everything, drifting alongside the trek, just past visibility, among trees at the tops of escarpments, at the fire's edges at night, Ludg is there, watching. Accumulating evidence, or terms of an equation. A boy and his lemming, out to see his own. Mostly what he's seen is a lot of chewing gum and a lot of foreign cock. How else does a footloose kid get by in the zone these days? Ursula is preserved. Ludwig has fallen into a death and found its nipple. So not all lemmings go over the cliff, and children are preserved against snuggling in a prophet. To expect any more or less of the zone is to disagree with the terms of the creation. When Ensign rides point, he has the habit of falling into reveries, whether the driver is talking or not. In night, without force enough to be falling, or now and then blown like a wet silk scarf in the face, inside and outside the same temperature and darkness, balances like these allow him to float just under waking. Feet and arms bug upward, pushing at the rubbery glass tension between the two levels, sticking in it. Dream caressed at hands and feet become supersessive, a good home-style, horizontal-less drowse. The engine of the stolen truck is muffled, old mattresses tied over the hood. Henrik the Hare, driving, keeps a leery eye on the temperature gauge. He's called the Hare because he can never get his right, as in the old Herero story. Severances are dying. A figure slips into the road, flashlight circling slowly. Ensign unsnaps the eye, leans out into the heavy mist and calls, faster than the speed of light. It fits him on. But in the last edge of Enzian's glance back, in the light from the flash, rain is sticking to the black face in big fat globules, sticking as water does to black grease paint, but not to Herero skin. We can make a U-turn here. The shoulders are treacherous, and both men know it. Back in the direction of camp, the line of slow-rolling lowlands is lit by a thud of apricot light. Shit! Henrik the Hare, jamming it in reverse, waiting for orders from Ensign as they grind slowly backwards. The one with the flashlight may have been the only lookout. There may be no enemy concentration for miles, but... There, beside the road, a prone body. It's Mietjaf Omuzire, head wound. Get him in, come on! They load him into the truck and cover him with a shelter half. No time to find out how bad it is. The black-faced sentry has vanished for good. From the direction they're backing in comes the stick rattle of rifle fire. We're going in mortar fire? Since the one? No. Andreas must have knocked it out then. Oh, they'll be all right in Guarareru. I'm worrying about us. Orutiene, dead. Ocandio, Ekori, Zire, wounded. Ekori, critically. The hostiles were white. How many? A dozen, maybe. We can't on a safe perimeter. Blue-white flashlight blobbing ellipse to parabola ups the shaking map. Till Braunschweig, if he'll there. Wren hits the map in loud spatters. Where's the railroad? Puts in Christian. He gets an interested look from Andreas. It's mutual. There's a good deal of interest here lately. The railroad is 6 or 7 miles northwest. The people come, empty their belongings next to the rocket's trailer rigs. Saplings are being axed down, each blow loud and carrying. A frame is being constructed. Bundles of clothing, pots and kettles stuffed here and there under the long tarpaulin between bent sapling hoops to simulate pieces of rocket. S is calling, all decoyed by the cook wagon, fishing in his pockets for the list he keeps. The decoy trek will move on northward, no violent shift in direction. The rest will angle east, back toward the Russian army. If they get just close enough, the British and American armies may move more cautiously. It may be possible to ride the interface like gliding at the edge of a thunderstorm all the way to the end between armies east and west. Andreas sits dangling, feet kicking heels against tailgate, bong, bong, tolling departure. Ensign looks up, quizzical. Andreas wants to say something. Finally, Christian goes with you, then? Yes, blinking under rain-beaded eyebrows. Oh, for God's sake, Andreas. Well, the decoys are supposed to make it too, right? Look, take him with you if you want.
I wanted to find out, Andreas shrugs, what's been settled.
You could have asked me. Nothing's been settled.
Maybe not by you. That's your game. You think it'll preserve you, but it doesn't for us. We have to know what's really going to happen.
Enzian kneels and begins to lift the heavy iron tailgate. He knows how phony it looks. Who will believe that in his heart he wants to belong to them out there, the vast humility, sleepless, dying, in pain tonight across the zone? The preterite he loves, knowing he's always to be a stranger. Chains rattle above him. The edge of the gate is level up into Andreas's eyes. His arms are braced tight. His elbows ache. It is an offering. He wants to ask, how many others have written me off? Is there a thing I've been kept blind to? But habits persist in their own life. He struggles to his feet, silently, lifting the dead weight, slamming it into place. Together they slip bolts through at each corner. See you there, Enzian waves and turns away, swallows a tablet of German desoxyphedrine, then pops in a stick of gum. Speed makes teeth grind. Gum gets chewed by grinding teeth. Chewing on gum is a technique developed during the late war by women to keep from crying. Not that he wants to cry for the separation. He wants to cry for himself, for what they all must believe is going to happen to him. The more they believe it, the better chance there is. His people are going to demolish him if they can. Chomp, chomp. Good evening, ladies. Nice job on the lashings there, Lyubica. Chomp. How the head, Mieczyslav? Bet they were surprised when the bullets bounced off. Chomp, chomp. Evening sparks, Ozohande. Anything from Hamburg yet on the liquid oxygen? Damned Oruru, better come through-ru, or we gonna have a bed-ass time trying to lay low till he do-ru. Oh, shit, who's that? It's Josef Ombindis who it is, leader of the Empty Ones. But till he stopped smiling for a few seconds there, Enzian thought it was Orutiene's ghost. The word is that the Okandio child was killed, too. Not so, chump. She was my first try at preventing a birth. So you maintain a deadly interest in her, chump, chump. He knows that's not it, but the man annoys him. Suicide is a freedom even the lowest enjoy, but you would deny that freedom to a people. No ideology. Tell me if your friend Aururu is going to have the LOX generator ready to roll, or if there is a funny surprise instead waiting for me in Hamburg. All right, no ideology. You would deny your even you enjoy, Oberst Nguarareru. Smiling again like the ghost of the man who fell tonight. Probing for the spot, jabbing what? What? Want to say what, Oberst? Till he sees the tiredness in Enzian's face and understands it is not a trick. A freedom. Whispering, smiling, a love song under black skies edged all around in acid orange. A commercial full of Cather horror at the practice of imprisoned of newborns. A freedom you may exercise soon. I hear your soul talking in its sleep. I know you better than anyone. Chomp, chomp. Oh, I had to give him the watch lists, didn't I? Oh, am I fool? Yes, he can choose the... You're a hallucination, Ombindi. Putting just enough pep to his voice so that if it doesn't work, it'll still be a good insult. I'm projecting my own death wish, and it comes out looking like you. Uglier than I ever dreamed. Giving him the spaceman smile for a full 30 seconds, after only 10 seconds of which Ombindi has already begun to shift his eyes, sweat, press his lips together, look at the ground, turn away, look back, but Enzian prolongs it. No mercy tonight, my people. Spaceman smile, turning everything inside a radius to frozen ice cream colors now that we're all in the mood. How about in the battery covers anyway, Juro? That's right, X-ray vision. Saw right the tarp. Write it down as another miracle. You there, Vlasta, take the next radio watch. Forget what it says on the list. There's never been any more than routine traffic logged with Hamburg, and I want to know why. Want to know what does come when Ombindi's people are on watch. Communication on the command frequency is by sealed dots and dashes. No voices to betray. But operators swear they can tell the individual sending hands. Vlasta is one of the best operators, and she can do good hand imitations of most of Ombindi's people. Been practicing up just in case. The others, who've been all along wondering if Enzian was ever going to move on Ombindi, can tell now by the look on his face and the way he's walking through. So, with little more than touches to the brim of his forage cap, signaling plan so-and-so, the Ombindi people are quiet without violence, relieved of all watch duties tonight, though still keeping their weapons and ammo. No one has ever taken those away. There's no reason to. Enzian is no more vulnerable now than he ever was, which was plenty.
The fat boy Ludwig is a white glowworm in the mist. The game is that he's scouting for a vast white army, always at his other flank, ready to come down off of the high ground at a word from Ludwig and smear the blacks into the earth. But he would never call them down. He would rather go with the trek, invisible. There is no hustling for him down there. Their journey doesn't include him. They have somewhere to go. He feels he must go with them, but separate, a stranger, no more or less at the mercy of the zone. Bridge over a stream. Very seldom will traffic come by overhead. You can look up and see a whole slope of cone-bearing trees rushing up darkly away from one of the road. Trees creak in sorrow for the engineered wound through their terrain, their terrenity or earthhood. Trout flick by in the stream. Inside the culvert, other shelterers have written on the damp arc of wall, "Take me, Stretchfoot, what keeps you? Nothing worse than these. You will be like gentle sleep. Isn't it only sleep? Please, come soon." Private Rudolf Effig, 12-4-45. A drawing of Mando Blackface Grease, a man looking closely at a flower. In the distance, or smaller, appears to be a woman approaching, or some kind of elf, or something. The man isn't looking at her, or it. In the middle distance are haystacks. The flower is shaped like the cunt of a young girl. There is a luminary looking down from the sky, a face on it totally at peace, like the Buddha's. Underneath, someone else has written in English, "Drawing, finish." And underneath that, in another hand, "It is finished, you nit, and so are you." Nearby in German, "I love you, Lisele, with all my heart." No name, rank, unit, or serial number. Initials, tic-tac-toe games you can tell were played alone, a game of hangman in which the missed word was never filled in, G-E-blank-blank-R-A-T-blank-blank. And the hanged body visible almost at the other end of the culvert, even this in the day, because it's a narrow road and no real gradient of shadow. A bicycle is incompletely hidden in the weeds at the side of the road. A late butterfly, pale as an eyelid, winks aimlessly out over the stalks of new hay. High up on the slope, someone is swinging an axe blade into a living tree, and here is where and when the young witch finds Václav Cicerny at last. He's sitting by the stream, not dejected nor tranquil, just waiting. A passive solenoid waiting to be sprung. At her step, his head lifts, and he sees her. She is the first presence since last night he's looked at and seen, which is her doing. The charm she recited then, fastening the silk crotch torn from her best underpants across the eyes of the doll, his eyes, eastern and liquid, though they'd been only sketched in clay with her long fingernail, was this: "May he be blind now to all but me. May the burning sun of love shine in his eyes forever. May this, my own darkness, shelter him. By all the holy names of God, by the angels Melchidael, Yahoel, Anaphiel, and the great Metatron, I conjure you and all who are with you to go and do my will." The secret is in the concentrating. She inhibits everything else, the moon in the junipers, the wild dogs out ranging in the middle of the night. She fixes on Cicerny's memory and his wayward eyes and lets it be basing her orgasm to the incantation, so that by the end, naming the last names of power, she's screaming, coming, without help, from her fingers which are raised to the sky. Later she breaks a piece of the magic bread in half and eats one part. The other is for Cicerny. He takes the bread now. The stream rushes. A bird sings. Toward nightfall, the lovers lying naked on a cold grass, sound of a convoy approaches on the little road. Cicerny pulls on his trousers and climbs up to see if he can beg some food or cigarettes. The black faces pass by, Mbakayere, some glancing at him curiously, others too involved with their own exhaustion or with keeping a tight guard on a covered wagon containing the warhead section of the 00001. Ancien on his motorcycle stops for a moment, Mbakayere, the tarred, unshaven white. They're in the middle of the bridge. They talk broken German. Cicerny managed to hustle half a pack of American cigarettes and three raw potatoes. The two nod, not quite formally, not quite smiling. Ancien puts his bike in gear and return journey. Cicerny lights a cigarette, watching them down the road, shivering in the dusk. Then he goes back to his young girl beside the stream. They will have to locate some firewood before all is gone. This is magic, sure, but not necessarily fantasy.
Certainly not the first time a man has passed his brother by at the edge of the evening, often forever, without knowing it. By now the city has grown so tall that elevators are long halls with lounges inside, padded seats and benches, snack bars, newsstands where you can browse through a whole issue of life between stops. For those faint hearts who first thing on entering seek certificate of inspection on the elevator wall, there are young women in green overseas caps, green velvet basques, and tapered yellow striped trousers, a feminine zoot suit effect, who've been tutored in all kinds of elevator lore, and whose job it is to set you at ease. In the early days, pipes young Mindy Bloth of Carbon City, Illinois, smiling vacantly away in profile, close by the brass moiré of diamond blurs, passing in vertical thousands, her growing-up face, dreamy and practical as the Queen of Cups, quite looks for you, is always refracted away some set angle in the gold-brown medium between you. It's morning, and the flower man at the rear of the elevator, down a step or two behind the little fountain, has brought lilacs and irises fresh and early. Before the vertical solution, all transport was, in effect, two-dimensional. I can guess your question, as a smile, familiar and unrefracted, for this old elevator regular passes between girl and heckler. What about airplane flight? That's what you were going to ask, wasn't it? As a matter of fact, he was going to ask about the rocket, and everyone knows it, but the subject is under a curious taboo, and polite Mindy has brought in now a chance for actual violence, the violence of repression, the bleached colors of a September morning sky opposite the sunrise, and the filing edge of a morning wind in this intimate cubic environment moving so smoothly upward through space, a bubble rising through Castile soap where all around it's green lit by slow lightning. Past levels already a bustle with heads seething brighter than sperm and eggs in the sea, past some levels left dark, unheated, somehow forbidden, looking oddly wasted, levels where nobody's been since the war, howling past, a common aerodynamic effect, explains patient Mindy, involving our own boundary layer and the shape of the orifice as we pass it. Oh, you mean that before we get to it? Hollers another heckler. It's a different shape. Yup, and after we go by it, too, Mac, Mindy brushes him off, oddly mugging the same thing with her mouth. Purse relaxed smile, these jagged openings howling, hauling forlorn and downward, already stories gone beneath the soles of your shoes, a howl bent downward like a harmonica note. But why don't any of the busy floors make a sound going by? Where the lights are shining warm as Christmas week parties, floors that beckon you into densities of glass faceting or screening, good-natured coffee urn grousing, well, golly, here goes another day. Howdy, Marie, were you ladies hiding the drawing, the one? What do you mean food service has them again? Doesn't engineering design have any rights? It's like watching your child run away to see a piece of equipment set out to the field, der Welt. That it is. A broken heart, a mother's prayer. Slowly the voices of the Lübeck Hitler Youth Glee Club fade in behind. Nowadays the boys sing at officers' clubs all across the zone under their road name, the Lederhoseners, addressed appropriately, and sing, when the house feels right, with their backs turned to the orders, their sly little faces turned over shoulders to flirt with the fighting men. But sharper than a mother's are the beatings Mutti gave to me. With a beautifully coordinated pull then to each pair of buttocks, gleaming through leather so tight that the clenching of gluteal muscles is plainly visible, and you can bet there isn't a cock in the room doesn't stir the sight, and scarcely an eye that can't hallucinate that maternal smash, the delicious red lines, the stern and beautiful female face smiling down through lowered lashes, only a glint of light off of each eye. When you were first learning to crawl, it was her calves and feet you saw the most of. They replaced her breasts as sources of strength, as you learned the smell of her leather shoes. The sovereign smell rose as far as you could see, to her knees, perhaps, depending on fashion that year, to her thighs. You were infant in the presence of leather legs, leather feet. It whispers that we all learned that classical fantasy at mother's knees, that somewhere tucked in the brain's plush album is always a child in Fauntleroy's, a pretty French maid begging to be whipped. Ludwig shifts his rather fat ass under Tanatz's hand. Both have perimposed to cross, but they have crept away anyhow, to a piece of the interface, a cold thicket they've pounded a space in the middle of to lie on. Ludwig, a little S&M hurt anybody.
Who said that?
Sigmund Freud?
But why are we taught to feel reflexive shame whenever it comes up? Why will the structure allow every other kind of sexual behavior but that one? Because submission and dominance are resources it needs for its very survival. They cannot be wasted in private sex, in any kind of sex. It needs our so that they remain in power. It needs our lusts after dominance so that it can co-opt us into its own power. There is no joy in it, only power. I tell you, if S&M could be established universally, at the family level, the state would wither. This is sadoanarchism, and Penance is its leading theoretician in the zone these days. It is the Lüneburg Heath at last. Run was made last night with the grooming fuel and oxidizer tanks. The tail section group has been on the radio all morning trying to get a position fix if the sky is clear. So the assembly of the 00001 is occurring also in a geographical way, a diaspora running backwards, seeds of exile flying inward in a modest view of gravitational collapse, of the Messiah gather fallen sparks. Remember the story about the kid who hates Kreplach? Hates and fears the dish? Breaks out in these horrible green hives that shift in relief melts his body in the mere presence of Kreplach? Kid's mother takes him to the psychiatrist. Fear of the unknown, diagnoses this gray eminence. Let him watch you making the Kreplach. That'll ease him into home to mother's kitchen. Now, says mother, I'm going to make us a delicious surprise. Oh, boy, cries the kid. That's keen, Mom. See, now I'm sifting the flour and salt into a nice little pile. Hamburger? Oh, boy. Hamburger and onions. I'm frying them here, see, in this frying pan. Gee, I can hardly wait. This is exciting. What are you doing now? Making a little volcano in the flour here and breaking these eggs into it. Can I help you mix it up? Oh, boy. Now I'm going to roll the dough out, see, into a nice flat sheet. Now I'm cutting it up into squares. This is terrific, Mom. Now I spoon some of the hamburger into this little square, and now I fold it over into a... Gah! Screams the kid in absolute terror. Kreplach! End of side 23. To continue, turn the cassette over.